So we are here today with an amazing instructor from UFV, one of many we've had on this show. Her name is Fiona McDonald, and she is the department head and associate professor of political science at the University of the Fraser Valley. Fiona, thank you for being here with us today.
Thank you for having me.
I wanted to start off by asking you a little bit about your experience in covering feminist political science. This is sort of your specialization, I would say, at UFV, but I imagine your work has changed a lot over the years. Can you give us a little perspective into why you feel it's important to cover this feminist perspective on politics?
My interest and the focus of my work has become increasingly feminist in orientation since I first started pursuing political science at a graduate level. You know, there have been a number of events over the last 5 years in particular, I think that a lot of listeners could relate to, that have really highlighted how not just gender, but also other aspects of identity, particularly race, are really central when we try to understand what's happening in politics. And one of the most illuminating examples of that recently was what the voter behavior data showed following the 2016 election. So while there was all kinds of theoretical discussion around why voters voted the way they did, who voted for Trump and why, for example, which, as you know, was a surprise given the poll indicators were very different, what the voting behavior data shows is that orientations towards a sexist and racist view were the number one indicators that somebody would vote for Trump. That to me is a really clear indicator as to why we need to look at issues of gender, not just alone, but also in an intersectional, a comprehensive way in relation to other issues of oppression and privilege, and why it really matters in quote unquote mainstream politics.
That makes perfect sense. And something that you've covered a lot in your work is actually how this conservative and sometimes racist and sexist ideology has manifested in Canada. Can you speak to that a little bit and how it's different here?
You know, in some ways, Canada is different, and in other ways, it's not. We're not seeing the same uber polarization that we're seeing south of the border. And there are a lot of reasons why polarization is so heightened at this moment in that context. But in Canada, we do see the rise of alt-right groups, this kind of idea of an alternative right. Some people don't like that category because they feel like it hides the white supremacist understanding. But for some academics, they use the term alt-right to indicate some of the unique aspects of the way these kinds of racially motivated movements are operating today that are different than before. We see those groups emerging publicly every so often. Perhaps the most well-known example would be the Proud Boys here in Canada. It's a world that is hard to track for researchers because so much of the membership is online. The use of satire is also hard to track exactly what the group is about, how many members they really have, what the beliefs are. And so there's a lot of work, I think, that needs to be done within political science and other fields to really try to understand more about these groups and the influence they're having, which is often hidden unless you're somehow exposed to it.
And you brought up Proud Boys. Other groups that come to mind are Yellow Vests. I've seen them around just living in Metro Vancouver. And the list could go on. Honestly, growing up in the Fraser Valley, it did seem to me like there was quite a manifestation of conservative beliefs. And that's something we've talked about on the phone with other interviewees before. The fact that the Fraser Valley in particular seems to be quite conservative and quite right-minded. What is your perspective on that?
You know, I'm not from the area myself, although I grew up in another area of Canada, Brandon, Manitoba, that is traditionally very conservative as well. And I think what you're seeing in the Fraser Valley with the recent provincial election is some change or some shifts. So we saw some NDP successes in the Fraser Valley that seem to buck the more traditional trend. So I think there is a long history of conservative sort of safe seats in the Fraser Valley, but that seems to be now in flux. So there's a lot of reasons why demographically, again, that you might see that kind of historic conservatism. One of the major elements that we look at in voter behavior data, and I don't do that work myself, but is the association with certain religious points of view and a conservative ideology. That can be an important factor when we try to understand voting behavior here in Canada. And of course, when you have an electoral system like we have, which is first past the post, you tend to have an overrepresentation of some political parties over others. There's a lot of Canadian voters who might not be ideologically oriented towards one of the two major parties, being the only two parties that have ever been in office federally, the Liberals and the Conservatives. Perhaps they're more ideologically oriented towards the NDP or the Greens, but they look at their riding and they know that statistically, their vote probably won't matter, quote unquote, if they chose to vote more ideologically. So that's a phenomenon that we call strategic voting, which is very common in Canada, often voting against someone instead of for someone, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. I voted strategically in the election to get Harper out, as a lot of people did. And then, I mean, look at the American election. Even that, you can see a huge trend in strategic voting.
I vote strategically myself, right? So it seems like from our Canadian electoral perspective, it just seems like the smart thing to do, because you want to feel like your vote matters. But it does mean then that we don't really have necessarily that accurate read on where Canadians really fall in relation to the political parties. How would we vote if we had proportional representation, if we felt like those other votes could matter?
If more women were involved in the public policy setting in the Fraser Valley, how would that make a difference in the actual day-to-day life of individuals?
We can look at some of the ways in which having more women in discursive spaces and in deliberative spaces can make a difference in terms of higher likelihood of a more cooperative kind of approach on what might be considered partisan issues. But I think something to really think about here is, you know, when we look at this kind of idea of a mirrored representation, the population is roughly 50% women. Should the elected representatives be 50% women? There are some instances where that is more significant in terms of the outcome of a policy than others. This is drawing on Jane Mansbridge's work, American political scientist who does really phenomenal analysis of these kinds of questions, whether or not who's in the room makes a difference to the conversation outcome. And her findings show that mirrored representation is most significant in three contexts. One is when experiential knowledge matters. So is there important understanding? Is there important ways of analyzing, responding to a problem that are really only available to people who've had a certain range of experiences? Now, experiential knowledge isn't always something that we value in politics or in academia, but we know that having some personal experiences can really allow you to understand consequences of decisions that are not available to others. So one example, a historic example, would be violence within the home, or as it was first discussed when going on to the political agenda, wife battery, right? Which was a very gendered category because of how gendered the violence in the home has been. And this was an issue that was not part of the public domain. Violence within the home was considered a private matter not that many decades ago. And it took feminists and those who had experienced domestic abuse, had experienced violence within the home, to get that issue on the agenda. So that's one where, you know, we weren't going to see a male-dominated institution understand on its own the significance of that kind of issue. It took experiential knowledge to get it on the public agenda. Now, most of us understand that that is a role for the public, that that is a political issue, and that the state does need to be involved in what happens within the home behind closed doors. That's a fairly recent development. Another context in which that kind of mirrored representation is important is when there is a history of mistrust or abuse. Now, this is really important, I think, when it comes to some of the examples that you're talking about. Would having more women representatives make a difference when it comes to policies around opioid use, policies around how to understand opioid use? Maybe. But what might be more important is what kinds of experiences do these representatives bring in terms of understanding the crisis? The third context in which a mirrored representation can really have an impact, and this I think is also relevant to your question, is when there are issues that haven't yet been fully defined in the public. Domestic abuse, violence within the home was one of those. It just wasn't a political issue. We know that the opioid crisis is understood to be a crisis, but how we understand it, the ways in which we engage with it, I'd say that that is still very much in flux. I think in general, more diversity in representation, diversity not just in terms of gender, but also in terms of issues of class, ability, experience, that's really when you start to get that critical threshold that you need for that kind of diversity to have an impact on policy.
Fiona, I want to briefly ask you about a specific project that you've been working on. This study is called The Alt-Right, Toxic Masculinity and Violence. So the title of the study itself implies that you were able to sort of elaborate on the connections between masculinity and far-right ideology. Can you give us a spark notes on basically what you learned from that for listeners?
When we talk about masculinity, again, there's more than one way in which we might understand or think about what it means to be a man, right? Just as there's more than one way that we might think about or engage with what it means to be a woman. But I think most of us would agree that there are some dominant assumptions that are part of our society that really impact all of us in terms of what we expect men to do, men to be, men to look like. And so a lot of those are based on, you know, aggression, a certain kind of strength, physical strength, and other kinds of performative aspects of gender. When we look at the way certain expectations of masculinity operate in our society, we can see that some of our expectations do really reinforce certain kinds of toxic gender relations. These constraints around gender affect everyone, including men. Of course, many men benefit from some of these expectations when they're able to perform a lot of these expectations. But really, the standard of masculinity that we see set out for so many men, they're really not achievable. To never need to communicate emotional kinds of crises, to, you know, always be dominant, this is something that is really limiting when it comes to men and their ability to have a full and meaningful life. And it's certainly limiting for gender interactions.
Prime Minister Justin Trudeau was the very first Western leader in some time to have a gender equality cabinet, 50-50. Do you think the federal government's given more words and less action, or do you think they're trying to live up to what they're trying to prove to the rest of the world?
I think Trudeau is another topic where you can look at masculinity. So if you look at the kinds of ways in which he has presented masculinity is different than that kind of traditional understanding. So if you look at some of the campaign ads, especially back when he was first running as leader, a lot of the criticisms focused on him not really living up to that traditional masculine ideal. His campaign, especially again, the first campaign when he was running to become prime minister, really focused on feminism and gender equality in its discourse, right? As you said, in its words. And when he came into office, as you rightly pointed out, he made a commitment to gender parity in cabinet. There were a lot of mixed responses to that decision. And I think it was a really interesting moment in Canadian politics because you started to see a lot of pundits questioning this decision because perhaps the women then that were included in those cabinet appointments didn't have the merit to be there. And, you know, we're not really hearing that argument so much at this time. It kind of was a big blip there. And, you know, there was a lot of good work done, I think, from a number of people in media who went out and challenged that idea to say, when was a cabinet appointment ever about merit in the first place, right? That's a misunderstanding of how these appointments are made. And when a lot of those people in media and scholars looked at those appointments, they actually did seem to fit the person's background much more so than we might see in previous cabinets. So it was, I think, an important moment because what we saw in that moment of public debate was that argument had really very little to no legs, if you like. And so I think that was important to go through, have that debate so that we could identify the fallacies there. So that was important, I think, in Canadian politics to be able to have that discussion. There's a lot of disagreement from feminists in various perspectives about how impactful Trudeau's government has been when it comes to issues of gender. And what you see is there are some areas in which we can see marked improvements. Perhaps one of the best sources to look to try and track those changes is the Oxfam report. So Oxfam Canada has issued report cards looking comprehensively at the various portfolios, decisions that are most relevant for gender justice and given the Trudeau government a score.
Now that America has its very first vice president that shattered the glass ceiling, how do you think that will impact other women entering politics worldwide?
It's very hard not to be excited. You know, no matter how cynical you might be, I think that you have to take a moment and say, wow. It's very easy, especially in academia, to focus on what's not being done or what's not there or what could be improved. But I think this is a moment where everyone should pause and just appreciate the historic impact here. And it's historic, as you said, for a woman to be in this position, a woman of color, a woman who has drawn on her experience growing up with immigrant parents. And so that kind of, again, background for somebody in that position of power is really exciting. And we know, of course, that symbolic representation does matter. If you don't see anyone like you sitting around those tables where decisions are made, that's going to impact your sense of efficacy. It's going to impact your levels of trust and the value you place in those spaces. So the more we can see the diversity represented in those spaces, the higher those levels of trust, like we talked about earlier, and the more willing you might be to become involved yourself. I'll leave you with one more reference if you're interested in looking at particularly how race and intersections of race and gender impact those who run for office in Canada. Erin Tolley's book, Framed, is a really in-depth look at the different ways in which politicians or candidates of color are engaged with by mainstream media, the different ways in which their background is discussed, the higher likelihood that they will have negative framing in the press. And this is particularly true for women of color. And we saw a lot of that with Kamala Harris, the way she was discussed, the way she was critiqued, was often very racialized and very gendered. Her win as VP is even more significant when you have that understanding of those challenges. That was really nice to be able to chat with both of you, and I look forward to hearing the show.
Wonderful. Thank you again for being with us, Fiona. We hope you have a great day.